In the unlikely event, and we have to acknowledge it's unlikely, we wake up Wednesday morning and find out that the State House of Representatives appears to be divided 55-55 based on the votes. What's the first thing that's going to happen?
Well, the leaders of the two caucuses will start thinking about, is there a 56th vote from the other party that would help to forge a majority? I don't think there would be an acknowledgement right away that shared leadership or shared power would be the answer. In our case in 1992, Curtis Hertel and the Democratic caucus, which had controlled for 24 years, thought about enacting a resolution which said, this is a tie vote for speaker in the following session. Whoever controlled in the previous session would control in the new session. That resolution never went forward, but that was the Democratic strategy. The Republican strategy, I and our team were seeking a 56 Democratic vote through the end of the calendar year. And only when both sides determined that that wasn't going to happen did we sit down and negotiate how to share power.
So the first thing you do is start managing a strategy to basically try and seize control of the process.
I think that would be the predictable next step. And part of that is leadership dynamic. The leaders of both caucuses, I think, would feel obligated to try to figure out how to put together a majority. Certainly, I felt that obligation to our Republican caucus, having been in the minority for 24 years. I needed to show the maximum good faith effort that we were going to try and be a majority.
What sorts of things get offered in trying to win that 56th vote?
Well, you hope you can find a member of the other party who represents a district that is more aligned with the party that you represent. So you hope to find someone who's philosophically comfortable in your caucus. But then it gets to the hard bargaining. Is there a committee assignment that would be attractive? In my case, I did talk with Democratic members who wanted to preside over the most powerful committees, and that was just too high a price. I felt our caucus should pay to forge an agreement, but it's those kinds of considerations. But I think to make it work, you would have to find someone who is really philosophically attuned, not only with the caucus of a different party label, but philosophically attuned with the district he or she represented. And that's very difficult. It's happened before, but I think it's difficult to find someone to switch parties or to allow the other party to control.
If you're talking about the prospects of actually controlling everything else in the process, why is handing over a powerful committee chairmanship too high price to pay? And then the follow-up is, why is it so difficult to get someone to switch? Why is it so difficult for someone to make that decision?
What I found was that members of the Democratic caucus who were even thinking about switching felt that it would be a betrayal of the party that had nominated them, and that it would be a betrayal of the constituency who voted for that person as a Democrat. On the other question, that was partly my judgment that it was too high a price to pay. But I think it would have been very disruptive. To tell you the truth, I, in the end, going through that process, felt that a more stable form of leadership, the ability to actually get things done, would be realized through shared power rather than a very fragile kind of relationship where someone has switched parties and could always hold that caucus hostage. And in the end, shared leadership to me looked like the better option.
That basically you're handing someone the car keys in some respect.
Exactly. I thought that out, honestly, in the next session when we had 56-54. Every member of the Republican caucus was always the 56th vote. And that's a very hard majority to preside over. With 55-55, you had to let go of control. But both sides knew that the only way to get things done was through consensus, at least enough of a consensus that there was a bipartisan majority. And in the 18 years I served, those 2 years of shared leadership were probably the most productive and the most fulfilling for me personally.
And that kind of begs a question, that would it be useful to the institution to institutionalize some form of shared leadership? And I realize that's a very abstract concept.
It is. First of all, I think lessons learned from shared leadership were that personal relationships not only count. Curtis Hertel and I didn't know each other well when we negotiated shared leadership, but we shared values. And the values we shared were the importance of the institution of representative government in the House. And we wanted the House to succeed. And we learned from each other that we could trust each other in pursuing that value, that goal. So personal relationships count, shared values. But the other thing we discovered is, as time went on, our friendship and our trust grew. And that was also true of the co-chairs of committees. And while you can't bottle that when one party has the majority, the other minority, I think you can build into the process steps to build personal relationships. I've always felt that one of the best ways to try to do that would be the majority would conclude that at the beginning of a session, it might be wise not just to rush to enact new legislation, but to ask the committees to spend a month or two visiting communities around the state and understanding what areas in their jurisdiction were important to citizens of the state, not only to help set the agenda together, but help to build relationships between Democrats and Republicans on that committee. It really does start with people beginning to trust each other and understanding that usually there's common agreement on what the problems are. The challenge is, what are the solutions to those problems or the steps towards resolving problems? And that takes time getting to know each other. And I, without having an even number of Democrats and Republicans, I think there are steps you could take to do that.
From what you've seen, do you think that at least some of the lessons of shared power are still recognized in Lansing?
I'm fascinated by the number of members, current members, and members who have served since I left, who have asked about shared leadership. And the interesting thing is I've participated in a number of orientations for new members. And I think all members, or most members, start out a session wanting to get things done and understanding that it will take bipartisan cooperation. The challenge then is keep that spirit. And, you know, in the current climate, that spirit usually goes away quickly, although the headlines report the major fights. Actually, I think there still is a fair amount of work done at the committee level on less controversial issues. And certainly there are relationships that develop across the aisle that result in problem solving. I think the challenge today, though, is how do you maintain the desire to do bipartisan work on an institutional level? And I think that does take institutional solutions, such as asking the committees to really spend some time understanding problems and getting to know each other. When I was a freshman legislator, one of the most important things that happened to me was old George Montgomery, a longtime chair of the tax committee, held seminars for new members about tax policy. And it was a very bipartisan type of seminar where we were just learning about tax policy. And the time that I spent in those sessions at the beginning of the 2 years, getting to know other members and getting to know policy was a really important step for me in working as a problem solver in the legislature. That was an institutional step. It was a step towards how do you build relationships? How do you get to know policy? And I think especially with six-year term limits in the House, it becomes even more important to accelerate that process of building relationships and getting to know policy.
And it's worth noting that Montgomery was a Democrat.
He was a Democrat.
Now, you did something else when you were the Republican minority leader, which was you created a bunch of task forces and did those sort of roadshows, although it was only Republican members, to go out and develop an agenda and meet with the public and try and come up with a plan for that point in time, if and when Republicans actually took majority. Does that experience play into what you're saying right now about learning policy and forming relationships?
It does. In our case, as a minority, we had served in that role for 20 years and had fallen into the habit as a minority of simply opposing what the majority was proposing. And we had lost sight of our own ideas and agenda. So those task forces were a step to get members in the Republican caucus thinking more positively about if we were a majority, what would we want to accomplish? the happy result of that was that an agenda was developed, and members in our caucus started working with Democrats about trying to achieve that agenda, even as a minority party. We became a more constructive voice, and I really do believe that was a contributing factor to ultimately our becoming a majority.
And also being able to contribute in an institutional sense.
Absolutely. We would not have been well prepared to serve in shared power or shared leadership, I believe, had we not developed a more positive view of how to participate in the process. And I do think both caucuses, no matter what the result in this election, really need to focus on not only what they want to accomplish, but how do you forge bipartisan coalitions around what you want to accomplish. When that happens, the solutions usually are better because you have more diverse viewpoints contributing to the end result, but I think they're also more durable. I think the institution tends to work on longer-term policies that stand the test of time when both Democrats and Republicans have worked together.
Paul Hiligaunce, former Speaker of the House, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.